Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Kayfabe Wrestling Radio, powered by Gerwack.net, Pro Wrestling Between the Sheets.net, .com. This also will be sponsored by RFVideo.com and HouseOfHardcore.net, because our guest will be appearing for House of Hardcore in April in the Northeast. He will also be appearing at the Parade of Champions in March, around the time of WrestleMania. This is a fun one because we've been doing the Asylum Years interviews. We spoke with TNA co-founder Jeff Jarrett. We have one that's going to be airing in a day or two with former tag team champion Andy Douglas of the Naturals. This one is interesting because this gentleman came into TNA wrestling a little before the Asylum Years ended, so if you're waiting to see him on YouTube, you're going to be a while, because he didn't appear until 2004, but he made an amazing impression. You first got to meet him as Dallas, and then thanks to another Dallas coming into the company, he became the guy we're talking to right now from the wonderful Delta Crown Lounge of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Mr. Lance Hoyt is joining us. Thank you for taking time out of your layover, sir.
No problem. I've got a few hours.
Yeah, before we get into TNA, we were just talking off air about travel for you, and for fans that remember you, you are not exactly the shortest gentleman in the history of the world. Which is the easiest situation? Because now you're exclusive, majority of your time you're in Japan. Which is worse for you? Is it the plane rides over there, or is it the bus rides and the boat rides that I hear sometimes last 4 days?
The bus rides, definitely. those can get very repetitive, and it's not the most comfortable thing. And, you know, I've done it so many times. You know, I've seen, you know, Japan's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country, especially when you get out on the highways out in kind of some of the old country. But, you know, I've seen it all at this point. So seeing it again is not something that I'm looking forward to. So the bus rides just get really long and kind of get boring. And, you know, you're hoping your little mobile Wi-Fi works, but it does only half the time, so you end up just trying to sleep as much as you can.
Now, as I was mentioning in the intro to fans that are going to see the Asylum Years on YouTube, thank you, TNA, for making this happen. You have no idea the suffrage that we go through watching them on a weekly basis. Hi, Dixie, I know you're listening. We love you, too. You, as I said, you appeared in the early spring of 04, but if I remember correctly, you had a couple dark matches. How do you even get on the radar of TNA to get a dark match and make that wonderful drive from Texas to Nashville for probably little to no money?
Way back in the day, man, it was an interesting experience. You know, I had tried a couple different avenues, things that had fell through, and ultimately, what helped me get my first explosion dark match with TNA back in 2003. One of the girls that was just one of the cage dancer girls, she went under the name Lollipop, came to an autograph convention that I was a part of in Dallas.
Oh.
And, you know, everybody's, you know, just hanging out and talking and this and that. She was like, oh, yeah, why haven't you tried TNA? And I was like, well, you know, I gave her my story as to how I had things that not worked out. She's like, well, give me a 8x10 and a tape or something, you know, and I'll get it to, like, Bob Ryder, who at the time was more into the office and making those kind of decisions and whatnot. And so I was like, sure, why not? And I got an 8x10 and put a little tape together and gave it to her. Didn't really expect much. And sure enough, she followed through. She gave it to them. And, like, about a week and a half later, so I got an email from Bill Behrens. And he's like, all right, here's some dates, choose one. And then that's how I got my first dark match, tryout match, explosion match, whatever you want to call it. And it was with Don Harris, and it went really well. And that was kind of what really gave me my first opportunity to work with TNA. Because I went a few more times after that and did the explosion and tryout matches. And then I showed up one day and in March of 2004, and I was on the board for the Asylum pay-per-view that night, teaming with Kid Cash. Ultimately, what had come about was Johnny Swinger had a child and couldn't be there for the night. They needed a replacement partner for Kid Cash, and Harris had put me over as doing well when I was there, that I looked like a bigger version of Cash, like a tall, big version of Cash. So they just kind of stuck me in there, and it worked, and, you know, I got a contract offer that night.
Now, for fans that aren't aware of it, you had already been wrestling through Texas for PCW, and I believe you were known as Shadow, and you had had a couple other incarnations. I know the story of how you became Dallas originally. For fans that aren't aware of it, just let them know how fast a name change can actually happen in the wrestling business.
Oh, man, you know, yeah, I'd been working on the independent scene in Texas for about four and a half years at that point. Mostly it worked as Shadow, but it also worked as Lance Steele and break down different independent names and different little companies. So I went to TNA to, you know, start my career there. And they wanted to change the name, you know, and there were discussions that it might be a different name from different cities in Tennessee and whatnot. So finally, I think it was Dutch Mantel was like, well, where is he living now? And they're like, Dallas. And they're like, hey, there's a good name. There you go. You're Dallas.
Now, who's actually... Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, luckily I didn't become some crazy name out of some small city in Tennessee, I guess.
You were Wewahitchka or something down here in Florida, or you were with... Come into the ring with Lucucci! And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Who's running creative at that point? Is it Russo and Dusty? Is it Dutch and Jeff? Who was actually doing the creative aspect at that point?
At that point, I'm pretty sure it was mostly Dutch and Jeff. I don't think Russo was around yet, and Dusty wasn't, as far as creative was concerned, around yet. But yeah, I think it was pretty much Dusty or Dutch and Jeff, and then, you know, you had different guys like Barons and Bob Ryder and Harris and those guys that kind of filled in and sat in and things like that. But it pretty much was just Jeff and Dutch, from my understanding.
He's a lifer in the business. I've got to interview him a couple times, and through going to TNA events over the years, I got to meet Dutch, and he's a lifer. What is he doing right that he was with WWE, then he wasn't, he's been running this, he was running Puerto Rico. What's the magic secret, you think, and what are some of the things you picked up from Dutch over the years?
Well, you know, Dutch does have a very smart mind for the business. He's very open-minded to the generations of wrestling and how they change. You know, I think the thing that holds some guys back as they grow older in the business is they get very stuck in who they were, who, what things worked way back when and whatnot. And Dutch had a very open and creative mind to what was good now, and would take talent. You know, he worked with Abyss and got Abyss to be who he is from his Puerto Rico days, creating the monster that became Abyss and stuff like that. So his ability to kind of say, this is what I was when I wrestled, and this is what worked when I wrestled, but this is a new day. He obviously can take elements of what has always worked in the wrestling business, but then kind of catch up to what is now, and I think that's what he always does. Plus, he's always well-respected. He never BS anybody. He's very straightforward, and, you know, it's one of those things that I think so many guys so many times are kind of told one thing and another thing is done, and when Dutch is very straightforward, he doesn't BS you, and, you know, you have respect for that. And so the fact that he's done that pretty much as long as I know him, has kept the respect level high, which gives you opportunities in the future. So, you know, when things come around, you know, even when he started with the Jack Swagger and WWE thing, it was kind of, they were in his home city and he wasn't even expecting it, and somebody just said, man, Dutch would be perfect for this role. They called him up and they're like, would you like to do it, try it out? Came in, did one reading, and there you go. Jack Swagger and Dutch, or what was his name in WWE?
Zeb Coulter, yeah.
Zeb Coulter. You know, Zeb Coulter was born and raised, and there it was. You know, so he's always had that ability to take who he was and catch it up to whatever year that he's trying to put together, whether it was 2004 or 2016.
Now, I know what I thought of the TNA Asylum fans. I've never hid my hatred for the fans of Nashville and Chicken Hat and all those wacky people up there. I did love certain people. LaVonda Bell is a great friend, and some of her friends. What did you think coming from where you had wrestled for PCW to this weekly wacky carnival-like atmosphere of the Tennessee State Fairgrounds?
It wasn't that much different from where I'd come from, you know. I
mean, oh, really?
PCW's it is in big Dallas, Texas and whatnot, but it was still Texas. It was still Southern Wrestling. It was a weekly show that we did in Dallas, you know. So the things that we were doing in Dallas, they were kind of doing the same at TNA and the Asylum, just a little bit on it at the time, especially a bigger scale. obviously with the weekly pay-per-views and the talent that was there and involved in comparison to what PCW had. But PCW had a great place in Dallas at the time. You know, we had our own venue, our own asylum, the PCW arena. We had video screens. Everybody had entrance videos and music and cameras. And we shot.
Wasn't it an old movie theater? I remember you telling me once.
It was an old movie theater. Yeah, it was an old movie theater that they converted into an arena. You know, they created a flat level floor at one point, put the ring in the center, and had an entrance that went into a gym that was behind it. And you know, it was a really cool place. It was a really fun place, especially for somebody who's starting in the business and trying to learn in the business in comparison to a lot of guys and girls who have to travel here, there, and everywhere, and they're just working one show a week, and they're only, if they're working one show a week, and it's in random places. And like I said, PCW provided a weekly show in the same place. You got to learn to do storylines. You created a character. You had videos. You had vignettes. You had music. You had all the things that went into a TV show that a lot of guys and girls don't get until they reach a TNA, WWE, or wherever they get an opportunity to go. And it's a very different experience when you're just working just a straight live crowd for an independent show in comparison to working for TV. And PCW provided an opportunity to get used to that. So when I stepped into the asylum, like I said, it was a bigger production, bigger names, and obviously on a bigger platform, but I'd already kind of been doing it, so it wasn't like I was jumping from one small, tiny puddle into a giant pond. That was just from one giant pond to another giant pond.
Now, you want to talk about people that ascend the ladder really quick. One week, you're just there, and next thing you're like, so, kid, how'd you like to be World Tag Team Champion? Great. All right, you're going to lose the belts next week, but you're going to win them back, and then you're going to lose them again. Is there a part of you that some folks get accused of being a belt mark, and is there any point that you go, I know it's a work, but still, I'm holding a belt that the Rock and Roll Express held, the Midnight Express held, the Andersons, the Briscoes, Steamboat and Youngblood held in their hands.
Right. Well, you know, and for me, unfortunately, I didn't truly know the history at that time.
Oh.
For me, it was just, I was kind of in awe of the idea that, I came in so quickly, and now they're putting titles on Cash and I. You know, and it did kind of go back and forth and this and that, but for a kid who just basically showed up, had no clue who he was going to be on the show one day, and it shows up and he is, and then the next week, you know, we're taping several TVs, and in that, we're taping an episode where we become the champion. You know, it was all very fast, and for me, it was more, I was just in awe of the situation, not knowing the history of the titles because of the NWA faction that it carried at the time. Now I know, you know, it is a cool idea to think of the history of professional wrestling and what it was and what NWA meant to the business and as it grew to what it's become today. And to know that, you know, the names that you just mentioned held those same titles, and to be able to say that I'm in that history books with those guys in some form or fashion. So now I'm more in awe of that, what you mentioned, than I was at the time, because I had no clue at the time.
You guys had, at that era, from 04 to 06, was probably the best era for tag teams in that promotion. You had Triple X, you had America's Most Wanted, you had the Naturals, you guys, Johnny Swinger and Simon Diamond, and then you end up facing a rather weird makeshift tag team that's still one of my favorite matches of you and Cash as a tag team, is the brawl around the asylum with you and AJ Styles and Ron the Truth Killings. You want to talk about like one of the weirder tag team pairings? That's just like oddball, those two guys being together.
Yeah, it definitely was, but you know what I mean? AJ has always been phenomenal from his time in TNA to obviously his time in Japan and now his time in the WWE. You know, it was just always fun to work with. He's very connected for us, I think, done his whole career. It just made it fun for us, especially for a kid like me who was still trying to find my way. And I just got to be the big badass and kick some butt. Those guys were so over, it just made it easy.
Was there a period of adjustment you went through? As you said, there were similarities from where you had been in Texas, but now you have this weekly crowd, and as you said, you're on pay-per-view. Was there a period of adjustment that Cash may have been able to talk you through, or some of the other veterans had to talk you through, or was it just, I got this, I'm ready, let's go?
That's how I felt. Now, looking back, you know, I probably should have been more not necessarily open-minded, because I was very open-minded. I think that's why Kid Cash and I kicked it off so well. The fact that, you know, I was very much, hey, man, help me out, work with me, help me get up to speed and do what I got to do. But I didn't, again, just like not knowing the history of the NWA titles at the time, I didn't know the situation I was in. I didn't know what I was really getting into. I just had always felt like I should be there. And so I just basically went with what I knew, how I knew it, and didn't truly understand the gravity of the situation to understand that, you know, this is a bigger deal than I know that I've been in before. Like I said, going from PCW into TNA, obviously kind of similarities in how things were run, but then you step into a limelight, especially for a company that's new and at a period of wrestling when WCW was the last competition of any sort to WWE. At the time, now TNA is a new company. People are paying attention to it. Again, it's just on a weekly basis on a pay-per-view, but people are watching it because they kind of want it to be something special. Like I said, I had no clue what that was. I was just another guy, wrestler, who believed he should be at the top of the game and was trying my best to get there.
The move to Nashville, from Nashville to Florida, a lot of folks said was great. A lot of folks said they hated it because it took away bookings that they may have had doing the Wednesday pay-per-view, and they would go somewhere else on a Thursday and they're on a Friday. Did it affect you at all to now go, okay, weekly pay-per-view gone, now I'm on Fridays at 3 Eastern on Fox Sportsnet?
Mm-hmm.
Did it bother you at all, or was it just cool, now I'm in front of a totally new audience in Universal?
No, for me it was totally cool. I mean, and I think all the people kind of involved within the company, you know, it's a progression. You know, you're going from the Asylum in Nashville at the Nashville Fairgrounds. Now we're at Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida, taping the weekly show. Again, the last time there was any other professional wrestling on a national basis, in any kind of whatever competition that you can say that it was, to WWE was WCW, you know, in 2000 or 2001 when it folded. And now TNA is on Fox Sports Network, like you said, on Fridays at 3 in the afternoon on the East Coast, which is a very odd time to be on. But now we're on national TV. You know, there's different Fox Sports affiliates around the country, but we were on all of them. And now it was a much larger audience, a broader audience. Like I said, the going from the Asylum to Universal Studios and just the upgrade and all the equipment and the lighting and the TV and everything that was involved in it for us, it was a great experience. It was a great time. And it was an opportunity, again, for progression. And that was, I think, for me, one of the more fun parts about being a part of TNA in that time period. You know, going 2004 when we were just on the weekly pay-per-views to when we were doing both the weekly pay-per-views and the Universal Studios. Then going from just doing Universal Studios with Impact tapings to now going into the pay-per-view situation. So being able to be a part of a lot of TNA's firsts, you know, it always seemed like steps forward and good things and fun times and, you know, getting to work with new talents and bigger audiences and bigger situations. So for me and for, I think, all the guys and girls involved, it was really cool because everything seemed like a step forward.
Mm. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the legend of Hoytomania and the biggest botch probably in the history of TNA wrestling, that they did not capitalize on the t-shirts that the fans created and did on their own, but still, yeah. That's got to be pretty wild to have come out and there's a bunch of fans and fan-made shirts cheering for you.
Yeah. It was a pretty cool experience, you know, and like you said, I believe it was something that the company should have absolutely capitalized on, but, you know, it's wrestling. I think a lot of silly decisions have been made over the history of the business, and this was just one of them. I was the young green kid, and yeah, I had captured the people's attention at the time, but I think it was also, again, a time in the company's history where they were looking to bigger names. And I think they just kind of always felt like, we'll come back to that. I think they felt like it was good. I was there. It wasn't going to go away. We're going to capitalize on the names of the people who have existed in the business and have made a name for themselves, get to the support we want to be, and we'll come back to Hoytomania. Unfortunately, they pushed it so far down, I think, that it kind of went away. You know, fans can only cheer for so long before they get tired of doing it and go, okay, we'll do something else.
Now to present times, because as I said, you are sitting in an airport lounge, which I'm sure is wonderful, because you are known, and currently you do work for, or actually let's rephrase this, you invaded Pro Wrestling NOAH, for fans that aren't aware of what's going on. But for the longest time, your home base was with KES in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Break down for the average fan that may just watch Wrestle Kingdom when it's online, and the differences, if you can, between New Japan and NOAH.
There's a rich history of professional wrestling in Japan, and obviously New Japan's been around for about 44 years now. I think wrestling based at world, it's starting to move Japan is more and more. Obviously, WWE coming in and taking some of the guys is a good way to say it. I don't know how to say it. You know, obviously AJ Styles now, who's with WWE, Shinsuke Nakamura, which has become a big situation. Karl Anderson and Gallows, who, you know, Gallows is already there, been with New Japan for several years, but now they're coming back into the fold, and Karl Anderson for the first time. So it's been kind of a big invasion of talent going into WWE, but I think that's because they recognize the talent that exists in New Japan and the star power that those guys all had. And New Japan itself, again, I've got to be a part of a company that has been around for years and years and years, and in Japan has been a big deal. But just in most recent years, has it become more of a worldwide sensation because they've done a lot of things and taken a lot of steps towards branching out beyond just Japan. They have their own network, the New Japan World, which is available in the States, and people can watch wrestling anytime they want, from a history of wrestling and archive wrestling to live events that New Japan puts on a consistent basis. New Japan has just grown and grown and grown, gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, I was lucky enough to be a part of several different Wrestle Kingdoms, you know, riding motorcycles and defending the IWGP titles a couple different times, and getting to be a part of that. And then now, you know, our larger group, which is called Suzuki Goon, which is headed by a guy named Minoru Suzuki, who has been around wrestling for 26 years now. He's MMA, you know, shoot fighting history. You know, he beat Ken Shamrock a couple different times in Japan. In real MMA style fighting, you know, so he's got a very badass background. And in professional wrestling, he's always been a super entertaining character. His history with the fan, he's always carried over greatly. And he's got the larger group called Suzuki Goon. And then you have Harry, or Davey Boy Smith Jr., and I, who have been KES, the Killer Elite Squad, since 2012. And like I said, we're two-time IWGP tag champions, we're two-time NWA champions. We're currently the GHC, which is the Global Honored Crown Champions for Pro Wrestling NOAH, and we've held those titles for over a year now. You know, for me, it's just been a great experience. Now, going from New Japan to NOAH, NOAH is a company that's been around for about 15 and a half years. They were a branch, a separation from All Japan 15 years ago. At one point, their company was big enough. They did run the Tokyo Dome themselves. Right now, the company is not that good. In that sense, you know, business has dropped off. They unfortunately had some deaths, like Masao, who passed away, unfortunately, in the ring. Talents that have left, like Kenta, things like that. You know, so the company has kind of dropped off. And with us invading the company, being that we made the name that we made in New Japan, the Suzuki Goon and KES, now we come into the fold and we create a new interest in the Pro Wrestling NOAH product. Working with the guys like Marufuji and Nakajima and guys who are truly, truly talented but haven't had the same platform that New Japan provides right now. And so now it's starting to grow and get better, get stronger, get bigger. So it's a lot of fun, but it's definitely a lot smaller than what New Japan is.
I got to put over a match that my jaw hit the floor when I got to watch it. And I've hit Ring of Honor up several times on social media going, I want to see this match again. You and Davey Boy Smith Jr. taking on fellow Texan Raymond Rowe and Warbeard Hansen, who are known as War Machine, or at the time we're recording this, they're the Ring of Honor World Tag Team Champions. Possibly the two biggest guys in recent memory you have been in the ring with?
Yeah, definitely.
Hardest hitting team in a while?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the more explosive talents in all of wrestling. with Raymond Rowe, and then, you know, deceptively agile and crazily cool, big, badass Warbearer Hansen. You know, we've had some fun battles with them, both at Ring of Honor and in Japan. You know, we worked with them a couple times in Ring of Honor, and then they came over and challenged us for the GHC titles and had a GHC title match, you know, Sokka versus them. So we traded some serious blows between the two teams, but we've got a great chemistry between all of us. I think our styles kind of all match. We're all hard-hitting. And like I said, you know, you got Ray Rowe, who's just crazily explosive. He does things and throws people around like you would never expect anybody to be thrown around. Davey Boy Smith, who's just freakishly action figurally big and has a shoot background that can scare anybody. You know, Warbeard Hansen, who can tope through ropes and flip off the top and do all those crazy stuff. And me, who's, you know, skywalking ropes and doing moonsaults and stuff. So you've got a collection of hard-hitting, hard-nosed fighting champions between War Machine and KES. And then you got guys doing things on a physical level for our sizes that most people don't expect to see. So I think for the fans, it's a lot of fun. And I hope we get to rekindle that at some point, whether it's in Ring of Honor, Pro Wrestling NOAH, or New Japan. Wherever they could be.
I'm going to wrap it there, but I'm going to let everybody know, if you live in the Northeast and you've been dying to see Lance in action, House of Hardcore will take care of your needs. Friday, April 15th, House of Hardcore 12, the titles will be on the line as the KES will take on Rhino and Tommy Dreamer. Now, this is where it gets even more fun. When they retain the championships, yes, I'm that confident in my friend's abilities. When they retain the championships, the next night in the 2300 Arena, they will defend against another interesting tag team in Chris Hero and Colt Cabana. And they're also booked for House of Hardcore 14, which is in, of all places, Niagara Falls. So you get to see him there.
Yeah, I may or may not be at Niagara Falls. I think I have a commitment with a company called, up here in the Minnesota area, Heavy on Wrestling. Champion, and they're running a show. They're running a show on May 7th, so I probably will be there. But yeah, we'll definitely be at House of Hardcore in New York on April 15th, and then Philadelphia on the 16th. You know, I've been lucky enough to work several of Tommy's shows, the House of Hardcore. The ones in Philadelphia are always crazy cool because the fans are just relentless, but they're fun all at the same time.
Right.
This will be the second time KES has actually fought for Tommy in House of Hardcore. But like I said, I do have to mention that we have a title match on March 19th at Pro Wrestling NOAH at Corkin Hall. So when we retain the titles then for sure we will be defending them against Tommy Dreamer and Rhino in New York. And then what will be our third defense against Colt Cabana and Hero, because we fought them twice at Pro Wrestling NOAH.
Oh, wow. He is at Lance Hoyt on Twitter. I will appropriately tag every single show in the United States that he is on there with. And we thank you all for downloading this, and stay with us as we'll have more great people coming up in the coming days.